And hello out there to all you Brooklyn folk and beyond. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Bedford and Sullivan podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners in the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series research process. And we once upon a time started this podcast with Mr. Larry King joining us, and he will once more be joining us momentarily. But first, I have a Mr. Rob Barnes with me, who you all have heard from before. Regarding both the Brooklyn and the Los Angeles Dodgers. And Rob, I greatly appreciate you joining me. One thing you and Larry certainly have in common is that that you're both still Dodger fans after all this time.
Well, yes, I am. And you know what? I can do a Larry King impersonation if you'd like me to. Hello, you know, you can do that if you need to. You know, hello.
Well, I don't want to fake out the viewers. Right. I don't want to take out the listeners right now. But,
oh yeah, that was
how you been doing? How you been holding up one way or the other?
You know what? It's okay. You know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, we have our health. We have, at least it's not February. It's not 10 degrees out. You know, at least you can go outside. At least you can. I'm a shorts guy. I'll put on shorts beginning in like April, and I'll try not to put them on until like October because I just like shorts, and it's. At least it's that, and I've always worked from home, so in some aspects it really doesn't feel that much different, and then other aspects it feels completely different.
Right. Yeah. And you know, obviously one of those big differences is the fact that we have not had sports this entire time, and July 4th, this Independence Day. You know, we're always used to. Watching baseball, maybe even, you know, joking about how awful these hats have become. But you know, that was something that was glaringly missing from July 4th, even though we do have an idea of when baseball's returning.
Oh, most definitely. July 4th to us, I mean, our daughter was home from the city and it was just the three of us home for the weekend. It didn't really feel like a holiday. It didn't really feel like any quote-unquote – anything out of the ordinary because we're just doing what we normally do. And you're right. There's normally a triple header or so, right, with the bat hats, as you say, on the fourth. And it's right. It's not there. You can flip on, you know, you can turn on the MLB network. You can find a playoff game from 2008, but that's, you know, after a while, those get a little old.
Right. And Rob, let me, I'm going to have to cut you off now because we do have the man himself on the line, and that is Mr. Larry King, who needs no introduction. Mr. King, thank you again for joining us on the Bedford and Sullivan podcast.
I'm happy to be with you guys. I heard someone mention tripleheader. You know, I went to a tripleheader when I was a kid. The Dodgers played a tripleheader with the Pirates in August. I forget the year, 46, 47.
Oh, wow.
So I went to a triple header.
And, you know, we're talking right now about whether or not they're going to need to be scheduling these double headers. Well, before we go down and we get into Brooklyn talk, Larry, I want to ask you, you know, how's everything going through all of this unprecedented times? How are you and your family holding up?
Well, you know, my boys live with me. And right now I'm talking to you sitting on the roof of my building. It's an 80-degree nice day. When I had my stroke, I lost my feeling in my left foot, so I need to be helped around in a chair, and I can walk with a walker. But other than that, I'm hanging in. You know, it's life. I'm 86 years old. I never thought I'd. I'm playing with house money.
That's a good way of looking at it.
That's what gamblers say if they're ahead. They say, I'm playing right, exactly. With house money.
And going all the way back, and that's exactly where I wanted to start. You know, it's remarkable. You sound great, and I'm glad to hear that other than, you know, the fact that you need a cane to get around the house, I'm glad to hear that you're doing well. I want to go all the way back to the 1930s in Brooklyn. And, you know, right now, as I try to figure out what I'm doing for a potential first season of writing this thing, I'm thinking a lot about the kids of Brooklyn in the 1930s. And certainly,
well, you got
fall into that era.
Yeah, I fall into that era, but I didn't really become a fan until the 41 season. I was not 41 when Mickey Owen dropped the third strike.
And
we lost the World Series to the Yankees. I became a fan in and around that year. Started going to games right after my father died. My cousin would take me to games. But it's through the 40s, the war years, that I was a Brooklyn Dodger fanatic. In the 30s, I was not a fan. I was just hanging around.
So if we can talk about that, actually, what is your earliest memory of Brooklyn, just Brooklyn itself outside of the baseball?
Well, Brooklyn was a culture. Brooklyn was a life. Brooklyn was a land apart. When, for example, we weren't part of New York. We were part of New York, but we weren't. When you lived in Brooklyn and you went into Manhattan, you said you were going into the city. I'm going into the city today to see a movie. You never said I'm going to Manhattan. You never said I'm going to New York. Brooklyn was always an island unto itself. We always felt apart from life. We were just had our own little bailiwick. We loved our borough. We loved what it stood for. We knew that Brooklyn was something special. We knew it all the while. After my father died, I moved from Bedfordstuyve to Bensonhurst. I had a great youth. After my father passed away, I had great friends. I went to Dodger games, went to Yankee games, went to the Polo Grounds, Madison Square Garden, college doubleheaders. There's a full Ranger hockey. We had a full life. And it wasn't that expensive. We hung in, you know. And box bleachers at Ebbets Field were 50 cents. You could afford the Garden for a Ranger game. You could get in for 75 cents.
So how old were you when you
were? Sports was a big. I was 9 when my father died. Mm. I was born in 1933, and he died in 1943. I was 9 and a half.
And that must have been real tough for you to have a father.
Very
tough.
Yeah, me and my little brother, who was 3 years younger. My mother never remarried, so it was very hard. We were on welfare for 2 years. That means they call it relief. Now they call it welfare. New York City paid our rent and gave us a stipend every month for food. That was for 2 years until my mother was able to go back to work. And I was then 11 and a half. I took care of my little brother. So I know what it's like. I know what it's like to be poor, and being not poor is a lot better.
Well said. Well said. What do you remember about radio from your early days? You know, of course, Red Barber started broadcasting in 1939, and they talk about how you'd be able to walk through Brooklyn and not miss a pitch. But considering that you became a media personality, what are some of those memories you have early on about radio?
I was very affected by it. I always wanted to be on the radio. I don't know where that came from, but I used to listen to the radio and then imitate radio announcers. A tale well calculated to keep you in suspense. I would practice. I would stand in front of a mirror and practice being a radio announcer. There were some shows that had studio audiences. I would try to get over to see them all. So I was a radio freak. I listened to the low soap operas. I listened to the weekends. I listened to the quiz shows. And naturally, I listened to Mel Allen, Red Barber, Russ Hodges, and the Dodgers, the Yankees. Red Barber was, he made Vince Scully, you know, he brought Vince Scully into broadcasting. And he was the best I ever heard. Scully second,
mm-hmm.
And then there was a bunch of other guys who were real good. Joe Buck, a lot of great, but the best was Red Barber, in my opinion, because Red mm-hmm. could, and Scully comes the closest, but Red could paint a picture. By that, the first time I went to Ebbets Field was 2 months after my father died. My uncle took me, and as I walked into Ebbets Field, and I saw the color green and the brown dirt and the white foul lines, I experienced something I felt I knew all along. Red had taught me that. Red brought the game into my head. It's hard to explain what a great announcer can do, but Red was what, and later in life, I got to work with him in Miami. I was doing sports, and he did interviews on this Channel 4 newscast in Miami. And to have him call me, you know, Larry, I would have lunch with him, dinner with him, learned about things from Red Bob, the great Jackie Robinson stories. But his ability on the air, his southern phrases, he was a Brooklyn loved him. You know what they did in those days? You wouldn't even notice. Old Gold sponsored the Dodgers. That was a tobacco cigarette. When any Dodger hit a homer, they rolled a carton of Old Golds down the screen. And they gave the carton to the player who hit the homer, and it was called an Old Goldie. An Old Goldie. The Yankees were sponsored by White Owl Cigars. They gave cigars to guys who hit homers. They had Ballantine Beer sponsored the Giants. I mean, it was all. I knew all the sponsors. I knew what they had. I flooded with it, and I would listen to spring training games. It would be snowing in Brooklyn, and I would hear Red describe what Vero Beach looked like. And I remember once he deceived Stan Musial to hit a homer into this lake, and a seagull picked up the ball, or in the lake, and Red Bauman described the seagull. I mean, picture that. There's a long home run, goes in the water, and a seagull just picked it up. I mean, that was Red. And there was nobody like him. And of course, Jackie Robinson's a great part of the Red Barber story.
Of course, there's that famous story of Red having an issue when Branch told him that tail is sitting down, and of course he went home and his wife told him to, why don't you sleep on it, at which point Red basically, you know, grew as a man and realized that I believe he said that, you know, Jackie didn't have a choice in what color he was born into, and I didn't have a choice being born into being white.
Yeah, and he had a lot to do with Jackie because he really liked Jackie. He took to him as a full athlete, treated him that way. He was one of the reasons Jackie came along faster than a lot of people would have thought, was Red Barber's total support of him. And Leo DeRocher, too, to his credit. Leo DeRocher mm-hmm. was a major Robinson supporter.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about the sponsorships too, and it's funny because last night I was watching a random Knot Hole Gang clip on the and the sponsor for that particular episode was the Lincoln Savings Bank, and you know they were talking about coming down to like four or five of the branches there, and I actually live in Flatbush now at 34th and Snyder, and it's a Burger King now, but at the top it says Lincoln Savings Bank. And so it's interesting you talking about all the different sponsors.
Oh, yeah, I knew all the sponsors of all the shows and the daytime sponsors. Oh, hey, look, I lived, breathed, radio was my life. And, of course, when television came in, we couldn't afford initially. Later we got a set. But radio was with the announcers. Marty Glickman was the best basketball announcer ever heard. Marty Glickman, you could picture the game without being there, without having television. Marty Glickman would broadcast a basketball game. Unbelievable. He was unbelievable. And we got used to the best in New York. We got used to the best. And I think one of the things I'm most thankful for is they grow up in Brooklyn.
You mentioned about the Yankees and the Giants, and one of the best things I've ever heard you say was that rooting for the Yankees was like rooting for U.S. Steel. I believe you said it for the Ghosts of Flatbush documentary. So my question for you regarding that is, it always seemed that the majority of Brooklyn were Dodger fans, but if you could talk about the dynamic of having two other teams in New York, and Brooklyn specifically.
Well, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. The three best center fielders for all the Hall of Fame all played at the same time. The Yankees, when you went to Yankee Stadium, you felt like you had to wear a shirt and tie. I was like, they were a little, oh, those were the Yankees, you know. Oh, my God. Pay attention. Not like you riffraff from Brooklyn. And the Polo Grounds was always somewhere on the other side. You know, they were in Manhattan. It's the other side of Yankee Stadium. It's a crazy place to watch a game. But the Yankees were, I would have to say, were hated. I hated the Yankees. Where did all that hate come from? Why did I hate them so much? I mean, I hated them. Hated the Giants, too. It was a remarkable time. I tell you guys, living in that time, I am so thankful to have been able to grow up in that era at that time. Even though the saddest day of my life was Bobby Thompson's homer, it's equal to my father's death. That's how deep it hit me. And later I would have a big dinner in New York where I had Thompson and Branca on the stage at the same time. And I brought them up to the stage and looked in Bobby Thompson's eyes and said, I still hate you. And they got to be great friends. And we later learned that they stole the signals. Yeah, the Giants. So, Frank assigned an autographed picture to me saying the Giants stole the pennant.
So, within the context of the recent sign-stealing scandal, you know, people were calling for the World Series to be stripped. In regards to the idea, if they were to do that, you'd probably have to take the pennant away from the Giants. What is your opinion on retroactively doing something like that?
Well, the Giants would have to go back too far to take it away. Naturally, if they knew it at the time, they would have stripped them. But I would have stripped Houston. I don't know if I'd have given it to the Dodgers, but I went to every one of those games. I went to Houston. I went, of course, to the home games. And I thought something funny was going on. I said to my friend, you know, they're timing Kershaw's pitches like they know what's coming. And they knew what was coming. I felt very bad when all that came out. So I'd have stripped them of the title, but I would not have given it to the Dodgers because you never know who would have won. But I certainly would have taken the title away from them.
Well, it's interesting to contemplate, and I think it's even more magnified in this day and age with this, like, the Twitter verse, you know. Mr. King, you're a very busy man, of course, and I want to let you go. We have Mr. Rob Barnes, who's also a Los Angeles Dodgers fan as well. Before I let you go, let me pass it over to him to ask a question.
Mr. King, it's an honor to talk to you, and for years I've loved watching you behind home plate at Dodgers Stadium on the broadcast. And seeing everything that you've witnessed, and you talked about being so fortunate to have been alive and gone through everything at Brooklyn. What was your first World Series game you attended? Did you attend any at Ebbets Field before the move?
Nope, I couldn't afford it.
Okay.
The first World Series game I attended was the Yankees in Atlanta, I think. I don't remember. But I didn't get to go at the great times, those great days and the halcyon days. I unfortunately couldn't afford it. And when I could afford it, I didn't live in the city where it was played.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
It was a tough. I got to run, guys, but I want to tell you.
Absolutely.
Reliving the old days in Brooklyn has been magical.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you again. Thank you so much, Mr. King.
You got it. Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Take care. So, Rob, what a thrill it is to talk to Mr.
Really.
King. You know, it's like,
wow.
I know earlier I said Larry, but, like, it's hard to, you know, you go back, you're like, well, Mr. King, what are some of the first things that you think of as you were listening to him? What are some of the things that came to your brain?
Just think, you know, having read the history of the Dodgers so much and hearing it from a firsthand observer, seeing, he was firsthand. He became a fan in 41 when Mickey Owen dropped the third strike, which started the whole rabbit hole of losing to the Yankees over and over again. Who knows if Mickey doesn't drop that ball, who knows what happens? Do they go on and win in 41?
Yeah.
And are they quote unquote cursed after that and go on to lose another, what, five times before they finally break through in 55? Does that change the whole thing? Does it change the whole, karma?
There's so many different ways that it could have unfolded. I mean, you know, part of the researching this entire story of the years that we've talked about is trying to figure out how it gets from Ebbets, building Ebbets Field, to selling mm-hmm. half of it, to the McKeevers keeping 25% family, not being able to handle it, and then eventually it goes, the way I'm reading it is McLaughlin wanted Walter O'Malley to pay a little bit more attention to the Dodger books, and then when Branch Rickey came aboard, that's when it all got put. They figured out the Ebbets shares. They sold the Ebbets shares. Mm-hmm. Walter O'Malley got a loan to buy the shares. So way this all unfolds. And you also have to have the Branch Rickey Zeckendorf moment when he leaves the Dodgers.
Yes. Yes.
But it's fascinating stuff. And he was talking about going back to 1941 with, he mentioned DeRocher, and I didn't, when it came to Jackie Robinson, and I didn't, I wanted to go down the rabbit hole with him about Leo DeRocher. But what's interesting about that specific moment was that everything I'm reading about Leo DeRocher during that game four, during that World Series, was that he kind of just mm-hmm. let it all unfold once the Yankees got on board. Like he didn't, he probably let Hugh Casey stay out there a little too long. And it seemed like he was, a deer in the headlights, it seems. And when you look at the fact that he only won one World Series as a manager, you wonder about these little moments, and it makes you want to dive even deeper as to what prevented, stubbornness, what prevented him from having more success, not only with the Dodgers, but overall in his career.
That's a very valid point. And what stuck in my mind when you're talking about that is leaving Hugh Casey in too long. I really think, this is a whole era thing. Pitchers were just left in too long back then. The Dodgers in general left pitchers in too long. They were known for putting, there weren't pitch counts back then. Pitchers were in throwing a gazillion innings a year and blowing out arms. Carl Spooner was another guy who was one of the King Carl, they call him. He was supposed to be the next great thing, and he blew out after a bit. Ken Lehman was another good one. So pitchers being left in too long, right? When something bad happens, you don't see immediately the manager should be coming out of the bullpen. You know, in 51, when they were at game three at the Polo Grounds, when Branca comes in, was dressing out there? Was he talking to him? Was he out there saying, here's the situation. Don't do this to him because Thompson had homered off him in game one. So I don't know.
Right.
Manager handling the
pitching in modern day. What's interesting too, specifically that moment, was that I think Thompson said something like they had been getting me out with that pitch the whole season, the pitch that he turned on. It's just so many different things so many different directions that we can go, and I know that I blanked on one of them. But one of the things that when he was talking about radio and how when he first got to Ebbets Field, it was familiar to him already because of Red Barber. And I thought about you that this was how you became a Dodgers fan was really because of the radio, right?
Oh yeah, I mean hearing a game or two, like I've told you, everybody doesn't remember, I became a fan by my dad working with Bill Singer. So I got to go to a couple games when he came here to Chicago because I'm a Chicagoan. Well, I'm a suburban, there's a whole whatever. I'm a suburban Chicago kid and adult now. So being able to see him once or twice a year, picking up a box score two or three days later in the Chicago Tribune, trying to recreate that box score in my brain, hearing a game once a week on maybe if they're on the game of the week, catching a game on the radio. Oh, yeah. And as Mr. King said, too, about radio, picturing painting that picture so eloquently as Red Barber, I'm sure he did. I never heard him call a game. I've heard bits on recordings, and obviously Vin Scully, his mentee, was able to do so perfectly for the 67 years he did it. So it's wonderful.
And we actually have another caller on the line from a 916 area code, which I believe is California. Hello, you are here on the Bedford and Sullivan podcast.
Hello.
Hi there. Who are we talking with? 916 area code.
This is Phil.
Hello, in Phil. Fact, how are you? Seeing that you're from that you have a California call, I'm guessing. Are you a Dodgers fan?
Oh yes. Oh yes. I was born in New York, but we left in 1949, so never really had a chance. But when I moved out to L.A. and saw them at the Coliseum, I just became a huge, huge Dodger fan. Anyway, my question, and it's kind of bizarre, and Larry King would have to be somebody to answer it. I've wondered about this for, I'm not kidding, 30, 40 years, and wondered why something at Ebbets Field was done the way it was done, and I've never been able to find out. I've written to the Dodger historians. I've gone online. I've talked to Ebbets Field fans through the years, and I'm almost 70 years old now, and I'm just trying to figure out why the heck this was done at Ebbets Field, why it was done that way. And my question is, why was the right field fence done at that angle, that concave angle, about halfway up, if you think about it, from right field all the way to almost right center and part of the scoreboard? And I've read everything. I've looked back at plans, and I think it was done in the 30s, but I know ballparks were built kind of like Wrigley Field, you know, with strange little quirks, but I just can't believe that Charlie Ebbets one day just said, okay, we're going to build this right field wall at an angle so it can take crazy hops or something. And I've never had anybody answer the question.
Well, I'm going to try my best from what I know from the history of it. So I'm looking at a photo right now during the era with Schaefer Beer at the top of the scoreboard.
Right.
So I forget exactly what this was like when Ebbets Field was first built, but the whole grandstand in the center field was a completely new addition in 1932.
Right.
And so that side on center field and left field used to be bigger, and in general, I think because of political connections, they were able to reroute the street to basically be right behind this new grandstand, this new upper deck grandstand that was built in 32. And so I think a lot of the quirks that you discussed didn't really get involved until 1932. And Rob, you're
right.
Also a good historian on all this stuff, if you can answer some.
I really think you're on the right track. I'd never heard anything about the street being rerouted. But the fact you look at the old pictures and you see the old pictures before the grandstand went in, I believe you're right. I believe the right field wall is different. I do. So if they come in and they're basically re-engineering the whole back, you know, the right field and out of the park, something has to happen. And why that concrete came in there, that's I don't know. Maybe just playing, you know, I think playing with someone's mind, but, you know, that's just a silly answer. But it's a great question.
Yeah.
The pinball
before the 30s.
Baseball. Sorry, Phil. Go ahead.
Yeah, it wasn't there before the 30s. And then I guess they remodeled Ebbets Field in, you know, like you said, 31 or 32. And in all the pictures I looked at, I've seen this thing and I go, there's no other ballpark that has anything like that. Why would they just, out of the clear blue, put up this 45-degree angle cement you know, edifice that goes halfway up the wall, and even into right center where the scoreboard was. And that's where I was thinking maybe Larry King, but there's no way for me to get a hold of him unless I go to a book signing or something like that. And I figured, but nobody knows. I talked to the Dodger historian. Doesn't have a clue. He said that's just the way ballparks were built. I've talked to some old Dodgers, and nobody knows. Nobody knows why it was done.
Well, I appreciate you, charging the idea up into my head to at least, like, from a screenwriting perspective. It's like, have this unfold, I can continue to try to get as deep and as much depth as possible with what this story is all about.
Yeah. And I don't know. I would figure I've been on obviously some of the Ebbets Field sites, and I figured somebody in Brooklyn that was there in the 40s and 30s would have an idea why they did it that way, but nothing.
Well, I'll also we from time to time have the Brooklyn Borough historian Ron Schweiger on, who was actually on the inaugural episode with Larry King, and I can certainly pose this question, considering that he has at least a replica of the blueprints, because I believe the Ebbets Field blueprints are now in possession of the Historical Society, the Brooklyn Historical Society. So I'll say about that for you, Phil.
Does he have an email, or does he give that out?
Yeah.
Or do you know?
Yeah, I can certainly inquire. And I'm pretty easy to get in touch with on the Facebook podcast. How did you come to listen to our show today? Which Twitter or Facebook?
Facebook. Off the
okay, so if you go to the Bedford and Sullivan Brooklyn page, you should be able to message me, and I get all those on the phone, and we can work with communicating with each other off the air via that. So I appreciate that, Phil. Thank you.
What's the name that it's under the Facebook?
Oh, it's Bedford and Sullivan Brooklyn. That is the page that I run that basically just, from a visual and audible perspective, keeps the audience active researchers.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, just message me there, and we'll take it from there.
Maybe find the answer to the mystery. Thank you so much for your time. I know it's kind of out of it.
Thank you, Phil. We appreciate it. Stay healthy.
All right.
Stay healthy out there with everything going on.
Yeah. Yeah, one day at a time. Thank you very much.
One day at a time. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
So, Rob, we're going to get to the tail end of the show, and you know how we always like to do the final word on here. And with baseball on its way back, I figure go ahead with your final word, maybe in regards to that.
Okay. Thank you. Baseball, couple of things we've seen, a couple of things I've seen online. MLB brought X amount of players back from the Dominican Republic, but I thought I read somewhere they did not test them before they brought them back. I mean, seriously, really? Why can't you do that correctly? Secondly, completely 180 degree tangent. Formula One auto racing, my wife and I enjoy that. We watch it. They returned to Austria last week for their first time, for their first race of the year. They tested, I can't remember the number, but zero cases, absolutely zero cases. And they're able to get their bubble down. I'm watching, there's this basketball tournament right now. It's called the Basketball Tournament. It's a bunch of teams that are loosely based on colleges, and they're alums of these schools. They're all quarantined in Columbus, Ohio. They have zero cases. They're completely locked down. They're able to, like, high-five and do everything and not be worried about getting touched. So why can't baseball do it, and will baseball be able to keep it down and be able to have the season go on? Because all it takes is for a couple of young 20-somethings to go out and you know, and get the virus somewhere.
Yeah.
So I just hope and pray we can at least see some baseball, because I know everybody that is a fan of yours is going to be looking forward to this.
Yes. And, you know, I, the more that one of the things that as I go through this and thinking about, you know, presenting this from a dramatic narrative perspective, you know, trying to remind everybody what baseball means to America, you know, because we have really taken sports and baseball for granted in many ways over the course of our lives. And you know, I'm just – sometimes when I'm driving around the city and I'm thinking about what we're currently experiencing, and I go back to how in denial I was leading up to everything shutting down, that like – and I'm sure other people – feel this way in many, many facets, that leading up to the entire thing, like, and everybody, people were, you know, slowly getting more serious about it. But I'm just like trying to put myself into that perspective, and everything's changed so much. Like we would have never thought a year ago that this is even close to something we were going to have to deal with. And somebody was just, it was either sports radio or something, you know, here in New York, talking about how we're coming up on the anniversary of the Home Run Derby with Pete Alonso. It's just like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That would be going on right now. You bring up a lot of great points.
Well, thanks. But it's, yeah, you're right. You take it for granted, right? It's always been there. You know, I don't know. You remember the strike of 94. I don't know if you remember the strike of 81. When it's gone, it's like, bam, they turn the switch and it's gone. And everybody's like, wait a minute, where'd it go? And now it's like, and now we're kind of living through the whole thing. And we've got the whole collective bargaining thing coming up and what's going to happen when it's over at the end of next year. And so why can't we, you know, they just need to get along and just realize that this is entertainment. You know, these guys are making
a combination. It was the combination of the flu, 1920, as well as the collective issues of 1994. That's basically what we were just dealing with baseball.
Right.
And my, you know,
exactly.
And they seem to be in denial. You know, other people are much more pessimistic about the future of baseball than I am. Because I'm sitting here thinking that, like, regardless of what television anybody's watching, regardless of what anybody is going on to YouTube, there still seems to be some sort of baseball foundation somewhere out there, whether it's from kids playing it or whether it's from parents passing it down generations. But there's people concerned and to the point that they think baseball has way too much hubris about their position in this in 2020 America.
Yeah. I mean, it's – oh, yeah. Oh, I think you're spot on with that, with them just being right. Okay, we're baseball. You know, it doesn't matter what we do because we're baseball, you know. So – everybody just needs to, you know, wear a mask, take a breath, take a deep breath, and realize that it's serious. We gotta, you know, we gotta just do whatever we can to help our fellow human being. It's something none of us have ever lived through before, and hopefully we'll never have to do it again. And just do our best and struggle and do your best, hold on tight, and hopefully come out good on the other side.
That is right. It's the only thing that we can hope for right now, and hopefully we get some baseball going. But in the meantime, I'm going to keep this research churning, and I appreciate you joining us today, Mr. Barnes, and I appreciate Mr. King joining us today. Thank you.
My pleasure, Sam. My pleasure, Sam.
Absolutely.
Great talking to you anytime. I'm always available. Thanks, buddy.
Excellent. And thank you all for listening to us on the Bedford and Sullivan podcast. If you're in the New York area, stay dry out there. But for everybody, stay healthy and strong. We'll catch you next week. Take care.